We got about an hour and a half of our show tonight. We'll take you till 7 o'clock. We've got a great show ahead. We're going to be talking about the labor dispute between Major League Baseball owners and the players, but with a labor relations expert who has a lot to say not only about particularly what is happening here, but nationwide and the labor movement. It'll be a great conversation with Michael LaRoy from the University of Illinois, a law professor or an expert at labor relations. Stephen Leahy is going to join us at 6:30 as well as we chat about all things taxes. It's March. If you haven't done them yet, you got about a month and 10 days left to do them. But there's a lot of other things you should know about. He's going to be here chatting about that. He'll answer your questions as well. And in just a little bit, we just had Michael Leonard of Leonard Attorneys on last week, and we were talking about federal court and federal crimes, and he's a defense attorney, and going up against the feds and how difficult that is. It was a great conversation last week, and then, bam, we get a huge federal case break here in Illinois. Of course, I'm talking about the indictment of Michael Madigan. So we immediately called him up, and he said, yeah, he'll hop on with us again. I'm really curious, and he's going to join us after a break here in a moment, about how hard it is to really convict a politician of, I mean, look, you can say what you want about Mike Madigan, and they always said he was very careful about this stuff. I know they have Alderman Solis, former Alderman Solis, on tape, and they may have some very strong evidence. But when you're talking about political crimes, sometimes you have to prove intent. Sometimes you have to prove, even if you don't have the money, exchanging hands. And it can be a little nebulous, like a gray area. I think if you were around and were paying attention to the Blagojevich trial, how nitty-gritty detailed it was and how you had to dive into the weeds. I'm not saying he's guilty or not. I'm just saying I'm curious about how difficult of a case that will be for federal prosecutors to prove. We'll do our question of the day. I'm going to tee it up around 6 o'clock, though. We'll answer that question, hopefully, and get a prize as well. I just hope you enjoyed a gorgeous day today, everyone. I know the Blackhawks unfortunately fell, but I went for a nice walk around 2 o'clock. It was 68 degrees. The sun was kind of behind some clouds, but I know this is like fake spring, but boy, it just felt good. I hope it felt good for you as well. And driving into downtown about an hour and a half ago, it is hopping. It kind of felt like pre-pandemic times. There were so many people walking the sidewalks, not a coat to be seen. It just lifted my spirits a little bit. And as I look out the window to the east, I can see at least the beautiful colors of the sunset to the west, which is 7 minutes away as those sunsets keep on getting later. Even though we're going to get cooler and we might get some snow, I just want everyone to think happy thoughts that spring is certainly on the way. Okay, we'll get Michael Leonard on here in just a moment to break down the Madigan indictment and more coming up on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN. The end of a gorgeous day in the city of Chicago and beyond. I know we got rain, thunder, and more on the way, then snow, so you know it's spring in Chicago, everybody. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Yeah, and as we track the weather, if it's raining or storming by you, I always love getting the reports on the text line to see where they are, and we'll relay that information to everybody else so we can plan our Saturday evening accordingly. Last week, we introduced you to Michael Leonard from Leonard Trial Attorneys, and I just said, you know what, next time there's a big federal case, I need to get Michael Leonard on of Leonard Trial Lawyers. Michael, I didn't realize I'd be talking to you 1 week later, my friend. Thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, I thought you were joking about having me on back so soon, but I'll take the appearance, okay?
Yeah, no, for sure. Obviously, the big news of the week, Michael Madigan indicted. And I should mention Michael Leonard, who is joining us now, has a track record of being an incredible defense attorney in federal case, getting not guilty charges more than basically anybody else. And that's, or not guilty results, excuse me, more than anyone else. That's hard to do. So, Michael, I guess I'll just start. What's your general reaction to what you've seen, read, and heard about what the federal government is alleging that Michael Madigan did?
Well, there's not, and on the one hand, there's not a lot new, but there is some more detail. So I think we all knew going back to 2020 that this was the government's intent. You know, the government likes to take their time and build these federal cases. And so in 2020, if you remember, the big news was that ComEd was charged in federal court with these very same allegations. And there was allusions to Michael Madigan, although he wasn't identified as Michael Madigan. So then ComEd in 2021 pled guilty and agreed to pay a $200 million fine for this conduct. So obviously everyone was waiting, when are they going to indict Michael Madigan, because that was their whole scope of the indictment against ComEd, by alluding to Michael Madigan, not by name, but in his position, everyone knew that's who they were talking about. So we expected this to happen, and, you know, it's pled under what's called a racketeering theory, but really in simple terms, it's a bribery case. Mm-hmm. You know, the heart of the case is that Michael Madigan, according to the government's allegations, was able to get ComEd to pay money to other parties, not him, but for his benefit. And so that's really the crux of this case, and we can talk in more detail. Sure you want to ask a lot of questions.
Oh, I do. But that was a great roundup. I appreciate that, the perspective of that. When you say bribery, and you mentioned it there, it wasn't direct payments to him. Like back in the old day, bribery was sticking money in a bag or an envelope, and it went across the desk. And this isn't. So what I want to ask you, Michael, is how hard is it for the government to prove some of these charges in this political sphere, right? Because I think it's a little bit nebulous what politicians are or aren't allowed to do, right? Like job recommendations don't necessarily on their face value aren't illegal, right? Like people recommend people for other things all the time. It's got to be somewhat difficult for the government to prove these things, right?
No doubt. I think this is a very defensible case. I mean, it's going to come down to a lot of indirect testimony evidence against Michael Madigan. You know, for instance, the heart of the allegations are that one of his right-hand man, Mr. McLean, was interacting with ComEd and referring to Mr. Madigan as our friend and essentially shaking them down, telling them that they had to hire certain law firms, they had to hire certain summer interns, they had to hire certain people. But again, that's not Michael Madigan. That's McLean, allegedly on Madigan's behalf. So, you know, it's not the money in the bag like the old days. You know, there's intermediaries here that would make the case harder to prove. I think the one thing that's a little bit surprising, perhaps, is that there are specific allegations where the government contends that Michael Madigan directly engaged in things such as phone calls and emails. And they claim to have direct evidence of that, which will take testimony from others who will say, you know, Michael Madigan told me this or told me that. But for the most part, you're right. The allegations are that Madigan used third parties to interact with folks like ComEd to get done what he allegedly wanted to get done.
I mean, it's all going to come down to, you know, what he said in these emails or these phone calls or in these taped conversations with former Alderman Solis, right? Because you can be delicate with language, you can wink and nudge someone along and kind of skirt the world of bribery. Or is the government allowed to say, hey, look, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, jury, you can say it's a duck.
Well, that's a circumstantial case they're going to put forward. So, you know, I think Solis is only a part of this. You know, the big players are McLean, who and some others who are allegedly interacting directly with ComEd. I mean, the other allegations you're referring to is that the allegation is that Madigan got Solis on a state board, and in exchange, Solis steered business from others to Madigan's law firm. So, again, like you're saying, you have these indirect connections with all this evidence. So it will come down to folks like McLean and others who will have to testify and testify convincingly that they in turn had direct communications with Michael Madigan. And that's going to be difficult to prove in many instances, because you're not going to have direct evidence of the substance of what Michael Madigan allegedly said to these other parties.
How successful is the government, either here locally or the federal government, at getting politicians found guilty? I mean, is it usually a slam dunk, or are they 50-50, or is it hard to tell because things have changed so much over the last 40, 50 years?
Well, I think statistically that they have a very good record. I wouldn't say this case is anything close to a slam dunk, but yeah, as you know, from the indictments and the plea agreements and the trials of politicians in the Chicago area and the state of Illinois, they have been quite successful. I don't think this case by any means is a slam dunk from a defense perspective.
Do we, obviously we don't know everything the federal government has, and in their press conference, obviously they're not trying to reveal too much. So what's happening behind the scenes right now? I imagine Michael Madigan and his attorneys are going to start to see that evidence, right? That's his right to see what the government has against him so that they can prepare a proper defense.
Yeah, something that you and I touched upon last week is that at the beginning of one of these federal cases, since the federal government has been working on the case for literally several years, they've amassed just gigabytes of data, you know, disks full of what are called discovery materials, witness interviews, grand jury testimony, you know, bank records, data, emails, voicemails, you know, anything you can possibly imagine. And so very quickly, the defense lawyers get a gigantic dump of the evidence, and it's going to take months, literally months, and probably longer than that, to get their arms around just all of the discovery material. So we would expect that to take a lot of time, but also there'll probably be some motion practice. You know, there'll probably be an attack on the indictment, a motion to dismiss the indictment, or other attacks on the legal theory here. Because, as you know, this is pled as a racketeering case. And, you know, traditionally racketeering cases have been brought against entities such as the mob, drug cartels. And so it's not always a political organization or enterprise that is the subject of a racketeering case. So I'd expect motion practice from the attorneys and then quite a bit of time to review the discovery and get their arms around it. I mean, I can't imagine a case like this being ready for trial until probably, you know, 2024 is a reality.
With a name like Michael Madigan and the reputation that he has, and, you know, people have been alleging things for a long time, and there's a very political, heated atmosphere here around Michael Madigan. How hard is that jury selection going to be once and if we get to that point, right? Like, that's going to be hard, and I imagine his defense attorneys are going to say, look, these people have preconceived notions going into this trial about who Michael Madigan is and what he's done.
Yeah, that's always an issue in a highly publicized case, including one, you know, involving a politician. So the way the court attacks it is kind of some different techniques to do that. One, there'll be a very detailed juror questionnaire. Well, they'll have to answer questions in writing about their exposure to allegations about Madigan, what they've read and heard about him. Do they have any preconceived ideas of him? Do they have any personal interaction from a political standpoint with him? So that'll ferret out a lot of questions during the what's called the voir dire, the jury questioning process. That'll provide a lot of fodder for follow-up. And, of course, you know, the attorneys on both sides will be trying to figure out, is there a particular bias either way in favor of Madigan or against him? There's going to be a lot of jurors that are going to have a quite favorable impression of Mike Madigan and may even have, you know, personal or, you know, three layers of connections to him. So, you know, both sides are going to be keenly interested in, can the jurors be fair and impartial despite what they know about him, despite what they've heard about him, either in a positive or negative way.
Reading through the indictment, you know, obviously there's a lot of things alleged there that are very serious, of course, and could, of course, undermine people's trust in government. How much does the federal government usually put in those documents? And I guess what I'm asking is, if someone read through the whole thing and they say, I don't see a smoking gun, is it because the smoking gun is going to be held until trial? What makes the government decide exactly how much they want to share this early in the process? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. In a politically charged case like this, where they know it's going to get oodles of publicity and attention, they are very much more careful and much more detailed than a regular indictment. You know, in federal court, a federal court indictment in a criminal case can be extremely bare bones. I mean, essentially, the standard is, you know, does it possibly set forth a federal crime, which the most bare bones of facts will satisfy that standard. You know, really, are the elements of the crime charged in a very conclusory fashion? So that's the standard indictment. This case is the jumbo. You know,
right.
So if you read this thing, not only does it 106 pages, but there is a lot of detail. And that was intentional, because they know that a lot of people will be reading this. They know that potential jurors will read this.
I was just going to ask that.
A lot of publicity.
I was just going to ask that. Is that they are trying? I don't want to say the federal government is trying to taint the jury, but I mean, I know they want to start setting the public opinion in that way, right? Like, I mean, that is a move done by the federal government intentionally, perhaps.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of laughable, because from the defense attorney standpoint in a federal criminal case, you know, if you're out having a press conference, you know, the federal government's going to accuse you of attempting to influence the jury pool. But that's what the federal prosecutors do every day. You know, they announce an indictment, they hold a press conference, they talk about the allegations in detail as if the person has done them, you know, as if they've already been tried. They put up a press release on their website talking all about the detail of the indictment at that very end.
Right at the end.
Notice, Yeah, right at the end, there's a little statement that says, hey, by the way, you know, this person is just charged. He hasn't been convicted of anything, you know. So it's kind of funny. So there's no question that the intent of the federal government is to put their best foot forward and is to, you know, you can't accuse them of actually trying to influence the jury. But let's face it. I mean, the net result of it is giving the public the facts so that they can be influenced at this early stage.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I think you kind of alluded to this at the beginning, but just, you know, having read through it, and if they're really putting a lot of their stuff in there to put that best foot forward, as you'd say, you don't think this is a slam dunk?
Oh, by no means. I mean, you know, some of the allegations go to, you know, Madigan or his organization allegedly, you know, putting forth candidates for summer internship jobs. You know, a lot of people won't be impressed with those types of allegations. Others are far more serious, and there is some detail to support them. For instance, they're alleging that, you know, to gain the confidence of Madigan and the Illinois House and Illinois Senate, the legislature, that, you know, these intermediaries would interact with ComEd and get them to appoint people to positions within the company as consultants, or to have ComEd use certain law firms. And so there's some more meatier allegations that will be, hopefully, if you're the government, supported by testimony that it was actually Michael Madigan doing that. But mm-hmm. again, that's the sort of stuff that's lacking. And, you know, the overarching argument is that, look, Michael Madigan, as powerful as he is, he can't pass legislation by himself. So, you know, there's still a question of if he was really exerting this type of influence. He doesn't have the authority or power, the argument would be, to pass these bills in 2011 and 2016 and 2018, allegedly on behalf of ComEd by himself. So that's a huge hole in the government's case.
Michael Leonard, I really appreciate your perspective. Just before I let you go really quickly, I always wonder, and I know you're busy enough with plenty of other things going on, but whenever you see like a high-profile case like this, does part of you wish, ooh, I wish I was in the courtroom for this one?
Oh, of course. That's any trial's dream. You know, any case that captures your fancies, you want to be trying it. You want to see yourself cross-examining the government agents and the cooperators. And, of course, that's what we all want to do.
All right. Michael Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers. Great to chat with you again, my friend. Okay?
Hey, thanks. Appreciate you having me on, John. Take
Absolutely.
Care.
Talk soon. All right. News next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN. 68 degrees at 6:06 on March 5th. Ron, we'll take that, won't we?
I'll take it any day. Yeah,
right.
That's unusual. That's fantastic, though.
I know, but it's that fake spring that everyone talks about.
It's not sticking around for very long, that's for sure.
I hope you enjoyed it. Did you get a little walk outside today, Ron?
You know, I did. I took advantage of it. There was no way I was staying inside on a day like today.
No, I had to go outside. If you didn't, and that's okay. It's still warm. Open up the windows just for a little bit. Just remember to close them when the rain comes on by. Thanks so much, Ron. Okay. Appreciate the chat with you again. Hey, this is Let's Get Legal. It's powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We're going to be talking about the labor dispute and the legal perspective of the labor dispute between the owners and the players in Major League Baseball. Stephen Leahy's going to talk IRS delays as well, and how they can actually get your passport, the IRS can. I didn't know that was possible, but they can do it. He'll answer your questions, too. The phone number for our show and all of our shows, 312-981-7200, I'm giving you that because we've got our question of the day now. So I believe we have the gift certificate today, right, Iridian? Yeah, this is for $50 to 50-50 restaurant group. If you answer this question, it may seem minuscule in terms of government spending, but over the next 15 years, 2,817,910 of our tax dollars will be spent on what? 312-981-7200. Over the next 15 years, about $2.8 million will be spent on what? 312-981-7200. Let's get a winner on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, after this on WGN. 720 WGN. Did we scare you all away with this question? 312-981-7200. Our question of the day seems to have stumped a lot of people. You can just take a wild guess, everybody. Here it is one more time. It may seem minuscule in terms of government spending, but over the next 15 years, $2.8 million of our tax money will be spent on what? If you get that right, you're going to get a $50 gift card to the 5050 Restaurant Group to be used at any one of their 14 fantastic establishments all over Chicago, including Roots Pizza and Westtown Bakery. Here, I'll make it a little easier for you. Over the next 15 years, $2.8 million of Illinois tax dollars will be spent on what? So we're talking about here in the state of Illinois, 15 years, $2.8 million. Doesn't sound like a lot of money. But when you hear the answer, you might be a little bit surprised. So 312-981-7200, starting to see the phone lines light up. I'll let Iridian answer a couple calls here. I wanted to tell you in the meantime that the eyes of the world continue to focus on Eastern Europe, and Ukraine and Russia are actually going to be facing off on Monday at the International Court of Justice. This in a hearing on emergency measures sought in Kyiv to order Moscow to suspend military operations. Russia's legal team weakened by the resignation of a key lawyer. The case is lodged by Ukraine at the UN Court, centers on the interpretation of a 1948 treaty on the prevention of genocide, which was signed by both Russia and Ukraine. Of course, it was the Soviet Union at the time. The court is named in the treaty itself as the forum for resolving these disputes. So this is what's supposed to happen. Russian President Vladimir Putin has suggested in a televised address that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a special military action protecting people. But of course, Kyiv arguing there's no evidence that genocide has taken place or was going to in eastern Ukraine. So I don't know how much authority the International Court has in this or if they have any power to stop it. But it is something interesting to be watching as we continue to watch what's happening in Eastern Europe. All right, we got a lot of callers now to the phone lines. About $2.8 million of Illinois tax dollars spent on what? Let's go to Bruce. Hey, Bruce, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Good. What's your guess?
I'm going to say toilet paper, but I think the amount is more.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it's more than a toilet paper, especially during the pandemic, right? Those prices went up. We're seeing inflation, Bruce. So, no, that's not the answer, but that was a really great first guess. Thanks, Bruce. Have a good one, okay?
Thank you.
Let's go to Barbara. Hey, Barbara, you're on WGN.
Hey, John. Love your show.
Oh, thanks, Barbara. How did you enjoy going outside at all today, by the way?
You know what? I took my 96-year-old mother to go see that Price is Right at the Rosemont Theater, and we had a ball. So it was a lovely day either way.
Oh, that's so wonderful. We got to cut a promo for that because we were giving away tickets for that sucker. Okay, Barbara, what's your guess for the question of the day?
So I did some math. It's about $200,000 a year, and I think that's what it costs to mow the lawn at the Capitol.
Oh, interesting. Like in Washington, D.C. or in Springfield, like that's how much the gardening cost?
Yeah, because you said it's Illinois money.
Yeah,
right?
It is Illinois money. I don't know if that's about right, because you imagine a couple people have to do that. That's a couple jobs. Barbara, your math sounds right. It's just not the answer to the question of the day. I'm sorry.
No worries. Have a good show.
Yeah, you have a good one. All right, let's go to Raymond. Hey, Raymond, you're on WGN. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for asking. What's your guess?
My guess is interest.
Oh, so like the interest that we owe on certain things to other people is just interest. That's a great guess. I wouldn't be surprised if you're right. It's just not the answer to the question of the day, Raymond.
Thanks.
Thank you. Let's go to Lori. Hey, Lori, how are you doing?
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Did you enjoy the nice weather today?
I did. I went for a 9-mile run this morning.
Whoa, Lori. Okay, hold on. What are you trying to put the rest of us to shame? I went for like a 6-block walk, and I thought, man, I did it.
You gotta start somewhere.
All right, Lori, what's your guess to the question of the day?
My guess is Illinois acquired 547 acres of parkland for $2.8 million.
Do you have this like... You're very specific with this. Is this some answer you looked up, or you just happen to know that's what Illinois purchased?
Oh, no. I looked it up.
Oh, okay. That's a great guess, right? Maybe they're paying off the parkland that they had. I had no idea, but that's not the answer to the question of the day, Lori. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, thank you anyway.
Have a good night. Great day. Keep on running. Okay. We got a stumper here. All right, one more time for people. Over the next 15 years, $2.8 million of our tax dollars in Illinois will be spent on what? And it's a very specific number, too, $2,817,910. And don't Google it, because I had to do the math myself. So I don't think you're going to find the answer anywhere. But if you have a guess, 312-981-7200. We'll have a little bit more time throughout the rest of the show for those answers. Tell you what, let's take a break now. Then we'll talk to Michael LeRoy from the University of Illinois about baseball, or the lack thereof, on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, let's get legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association here at 620. Professor from the University of Illinois, labor relations and labor law expert, Professor Michael LeRoy joins us. Professor, it's great to have you on. Let's get legal again.
Thank you, John.
And I'm a huge baseball fan. I know you are too. So it's with, I don't know, heavy hearts longing for spring, the ever eternal optimism that April brings on the north or south sides of Chicago or wherever you watch baseball, that we have to have this conversation. But it's kind of in your wheelhouse. What's your immediate take on where we're at with the players and the owners of Major League Baseball?
Well, first of all, John, for those people who have followed this relationship between the players' union and Major League Baseball, this was in the cards 5 years ago when they signed their last agreement. The players have been steadily losing out on their share of revenue growth generated by the owners. We can all relate to the reality that many teams have started their own baseball networks or channels or streaming services, and the players are getting basically stagnant pay. If you're looking at this from a fan perspective, you tend to think of the $300 million plus contracts that elite stars make. That sort of masks the reality that the ordinary player, the journeyman player, has basically earned $4 million 5 years ago and is stuck at that. So players want a bigger share of the pie.
I want to make sure I understand. So you're saying that revenues have gone up for the past 5 years, even with a year in the tank, essentially, because of COVID, or without fans and or
no,
limited
that,
fans.
John, that's a good qualification. That's a point that the owners have in their favor. So there has been a real interruption. That said, we are past that.
So basically, you know, is this common in, let's take it out of baseball and let's look at other labor disputes in the history of this country. Is that often what workers argue and ultimately are successful at, is like, look, maybe we're making okay money compared to other people, but if you are making a ton more money because of all these extra revenue streams, we should get a piece of a pie. I'm just trying to relate it to our listeners who maybe are in a union themselves and have gone through a similar thing.
So most of our listeners who are union members would say that their experience has been quite disappointing in terms of not getting in on the success of their firms. That's not a uniform statement, but for the past 50 years, since the mid-1970s or so, we have seen a really steady erosion of union bargaining power. There are many causes. Court rulings have weakened our labor law. The globalization of the economy until recently basically led to huge pressure on industrial manufacturers. Chicago was heavily hit by this. Loss of steel manufacturing and other industrial jobs. And so the unionized sector has shrunk from roughly 33-34% in the mid-1950s, 22% in the late 1970s. The private sector is down to 6-7%. So for workers who are in that space, they would say baseball players are essentially having a rich man's version of the disappointment that they've had with collective bargaining.
Who has the leverage here by the season not starting on time? Do owners have it because they say, look, you're not getting paid? Or do some of the players have it because they've developed personal war chests that they can kind of ride out the owners? And at some point, the owners need to have baseball. There's a lot that goes into the business of baseball. Do you have a prognostication on who has kind of more of the leverage here?
Every day that passes, the players gain incrementally an advantage in terms of the strength of their bargaining power. You know, there's a leading theory of strikes, and it goes back over 50 years. It says that strikes occur and are prolonged because each side miscalculates the other side's strike costs. So let's unpack that in this context. What this would mean is that the MLB, in implementing the lockout on December 1st, assumed that there would be cleavages and internal pressures in the Players Association by now, and that the players would cave. Bear in mind, most of the players who would vote on a collective bargaining agreement are not stars. They're journeyman players. They need the money or want the money. So, but I think MLB has miscalculated the unity and strength of the players as well as their war chest. They have planned for the past 5 years for a labor dispute of some kind. And they are rumored to have purchased a stake in an online sports platform years ago. They're sitting on money, a lot of money.
And yeah, either way, you cut it, they were preparing.
Oh, yeah. And so they're in for the long haul. And John, it's really important to note that this union has had the most success engaging in a strike. It was just one strike. Longtime baseball fans will remember the 1994-1995 strike. They won't remember it with fondness. It was a terrible thing, and it really altered the sport. But the players stood up to management, and they got the kind of agreement they wanted. And part of what could be driving this dispute, John, is the fact that players get 54% of the revenue. Again, the players are focused on the new money coming into the sport as a result of these media deals and the fact that the current formula, and especially, John, the fact that younger players who blossom really early in their careers, very different from 30, 40, 50 years ago, they're seeing playing time. They become stars at a young age, and the contract inhibits them from making the money that they're really owed.
Remember in 1995, they started, I was all of 11 years old. And by the way, I was a Cubs fan. I am a lifelong Cubs fan. So 94 didn't hurt me as much as White Sox fans, as the White Sox were in first place and looked to be rolling maybe on their way to a pennant, but I digress. Yeah. In early 95, I remember the minor leaguers starting to warm up, maybe even spring training. People have said, well, I wonder if that's going to happen again. But the minor leaguers are in a huge dispute with Major League Baseball, too, right now.
Anytime there's a labor dispute, they are concerned about people who cross the picket line who are derisively called scabs. It's always a possibility. I can't predict, but I would say that the relationship between minor league players is now openly hostile. And it goes just beyond the fact that they have filed a lawsuit. Many minor league players play for about $16,000 for a season, and they often have to pick up their own hotel rooms.
Did you say 16 or 60?
16. I mean, they are, you know, phenomenally underpaid. They're asking for minimum wage and overtime is what they're asking for. How about that? Who knew? And in addition, what Major League Baseball has done is they have essentially taken 40 of the 160 minor league franchises in the MLB network out of business. Now, if they form their own league, they do it. But so minor leaguers have two concerns. One, basically 25% of their labor market has been cut off by this monopoly called Major League Baseball. And two, they're getting minimum wage, or they're not getting even minimum wage. So they have a real chip on their shoulder. There's always a guy who will cross that picket line, and then there's always somebody to say unkind things to them. I don't know, but I think it's less likely today than 1995.
All right, I want to zoom out just a little bit, talk about labor stuff all over the United States. You kind of talked about it earlier on, but we have Starbucks, you know, the idea of unionizing in very small numbers or little localized spots. That's a huge story. And in general, workers have a lot of power right now. Do you potentially see a renaissance of unionized labor having more strength, or is this just a blip in the timeline?
So I've been studying this for 30 years, and for about 27 years, it's been just a steady decline of union power and influence in the workplace. That has started to reverse course. And so it's new for me is what I'm saying. And I have to rethink this. There are sort of shoots of green here for the labor movement, but I don't get, you asked a question that I should have answered a few moments ago. For, you know, ordinary industrial unions, and, you know, I'm thinking about labor disputes that we've seen in food processing in particular, you know, meatpacking plants, bakeries, things like this. Workers are finally getting really strong contractual gains on the order of 8, 9, 10% a year. And that looks big, and it makes the news story. It's like, oh, this is inflationary. And I suppose it is. What the news accounts don't say is they've been giving back year after year after year. And from the worker's perspective, they're in the hole. Okay.
Still, yeah.
And so, I'm not a labor economist, but I'm just saying you need a bigger frame of reference to understand what's going on here. I also think the labor movement has finally gotten creative, adaptive. It needs to think smaller scale. And a lot of times, John, they're not necessarily going for a conventional collective bargaining relationship. Chicago's a really good illustration of this, where you have unions pressing the city for wage laws. This has been going on for a long time. So you have what I tell my students is statutory collective bargaining. Statute refers to a law. The union is saying, you know what, instead of going through organizing and possibly a strike, we're going to use our political influence, if we have it, to negotiate a pay raise for everybody in the jurisdiction. And unions have been quite successful at that.
That was a very long, educated, and thoughtful response that also seems to have a we'll wait and see feel to it as well. As
that's
we take
right,
a
John.
Wider. Professor, really great to chat with you again. Thanks for breaking this all down for us.
Thank you, John.
All right, we'll hope to get an answer to the question of the day as well coming up and talk to Stephen Leahy after the news here on WGN. Stephen Leahy is going to be chatting with us in a moment. You know him. He's a tax attorney. And I'm actually really freaked out that the feds are going to come after me for something. So, Stephen, while I take a couple other quick calls, just start preparing a detailed response to calm me down. Our question of the day today, it may seem minuscule in terms of government spending, but over the next 15 years, $2.8 million of Illinois tax dollars will be spent on what? Really quickly, let's go to Marla. Hey, Marla, you're on WGN.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
What's your guess?
Is it related to the tollway?
Like that the Illinois would have to pay the tollway or the to upkeep of the tollway system?
Like upkeep or even something to the booth that they still have.
Oh, that's a great, yeah, right, because like $2 million isn't a ton of money. We have less tolls. Yeah. I see where you're going, Marla. It's just not the answer to the question of the day. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, love hearing from you. Let's go to Tom. Hey, Tom.
Hello.
How are you, my friend?
Good, you?
Very good, very good. Thanks for asking. What's your guess?
Cow gas emissions.
Cow gas emissions, like that Illinois would have to pay a penalty for the cow gas emissions, or or they would pay to collect them?
Impact on the environment.
Oh, no, that's a great guess, but it's not the answer to the day, to the question of the day. I'm sorry, Tom. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Carol. Hey, Carol, you're on WGN. How are you doing, Carol?
Good. Real good, thank you.
Thank you. What's your guess?
Bridge and road construction.
Great guess, right? But actually, I looked it up. In Illinois, over the next 6 years, or excuse me, the last couple years and the next four, so over a six-year period, Illinois is dedicating $45 billion to infrastructure. And I think that was before the federal government stepped in with their $1 trillion bipartisan
I know they're helping, too. So.
Yeah, exactly. So. Carol, great guess. So that was Iridian's first guess, too. So thanks for calling in.
You're welcome.
I always appreciate it. 312-981-7200 if you've got a guess. All right, let's get Stephen Leahy on here. Stephen, I'm scared, okay?
Well, don't be afraid, John. Let me walk you down from this.
WGNTaxman.com for all your information. All right, Stephen, so here's the thing that I want to talk about. I bet other people are going through this too. Circumstances in their personal life changed over the course of the pandemic, specifically in 2021. I used to be primarily like a W-2 employee based things at different jobs. Things changed a little bit last year. All of a sudden, my independent contractor work went way up, more than I expected. So I ended up owing the feds this year, right? And that's fine. Mm-hmm. They are earned that money. And now you're telling me that people that underpay on those estimated taxes, those quarterly taxes, could get an additional penalty for that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, when you owe, like when you finish this year and you owe, let's say you owe $12,000, and of course I don't know what you owe. I'm just using it because the math is easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's say it's $12,000. Then next year you have to pay $3,000 a quarter.
Okay.
If you don't pay it, well, then you pay interest on the money that you were supposed to pay. So the IRS is trying to change the name, right, because it's a penalty for underpayment of estimated taxes. But they want to just say, let's just call it interest, okay? Well, people get angry when we call it a penalty.
Well, I guess it kind of makes sense, right, because in their theory, it's otherwise people would always wait, because why not keep the money in your pocket or invest it in however you want? Well, you can. And if you're going to make interest on it, the government should be able to do it. Now, you may disagree with that, or other listeners may, but I get what you're saying. For my particular, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Jeff. I was going to say for my particular situation, because I'm the host of the show, but I really do feel like other people may be going through this too. If this is the first year I've owed, like in the previous years I didn't, I was either given a refund or kind of broke even. If this is the first year I'm owed, do I at least get like a reprieve? And now that as long as I pay on April 15th, my first quarter, I'm going to be okay?
The answer is yes.
Oh,
the IRS didn't know that you had that you were going to owe money, and you didn't either. But now this year, when you pay that, whatever that amount is that you're paying is going to be divided by four, and you're going to get, when you file your tax return, if you have a tax preparer, they'll give you a voucher for dated for the next four quarters,
uh-huh.
and you're supposed to pay that voucher every quarter as okay. you go forward. So this year, no. Then you're right about this, is that we are a, United States is a pay-as-you-go tax system,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you're a W-2 employee, they take it out of your tax, of your paycheck, and they send it to the government every, you know, as soon as you get paid. So they're trying to do that. They want, small business people to do the same thing. Pay as you go. As you make the money, then you're supposed to pay it.
Which, you know, people might be bummed out by it, but mm-hmm. it does save you a big bill at the end of the year, too. It kind of delineates it, because then when you mm-hmm. report your taxes the next year, you say, here's what I've already paid, mm-hmm. and then they sort it out from there, right?
Exactly. And if you overpay, maybe next year I don't owe as much, mm-hmm. well, then you get a refund like everybody else.
Right.
Like most people, right? Most people get a refund.
But that means I didn't make as much. So, Stephen, I don't know I don't know what to feel.
Always want to make more.
Okay. All right. That's right. That's right. I forgot what the name of the game was. All right. Okay. So I imagine there's other people there. So just if it's the first year because of the pandemic, things change in your personal work life, you pay what you owe the federal government now, and then divide that by four, or there's a form to fill out to try and estimate what it's going to be for the year and just pay it every quarter. And some of that times, if it's a certain amount, you have to pay the state as well, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
I love having my own personal show to just work out my problems with Stephen Leahy.
Happy to help.
IRS delays. I know we've talked about this ad nauseum last yeah. year. Are we anticipating the same thing this year?
Well, yes. The answer is yes. If you file a paper return. So don't file a paper return. File electronically. And if, you know, I think I've put on the show before, if you go to tinyurl.com/WGN free file, there's a list of free software that you can file electronically for free if you make less than $73,000 a year.
Give us that tiny URL. You always tell that to Hochberg, and he makes fun of you. I'm not going to stoop that low, Stephen. All I'm going to say is tell us it again.
tinyurl.com/WGN free file.
Free file. Okay.
It'll take you to the IRS website, and the IRS website has at least seven companies that are participating in this program. Again, to let you file your tax returns for free electronically. And if you file for free and you give them your checking account information on the form, then they'll give you the money. You'll get direct deposit. And that's the fastest, best way to get not to be held up. Because what's really holding the IRS up and all of these backlogs that you hear about, it's all the paper filing. And the paper filing, also because they had to change a lot of the returns last year because of they changed the laws retroactively. So many people had already filed, and then the law changed, and the IRS had to go back and do all those by hand.
All right. Let's say you are expecting a refund, or they're going to take some of your money. Either way, when you get the words, this has been approved by the IRS, which can come quickly, right? Like you get a text on your phone if that's how you file it, whatever it is. Does that mean you're in the clear for an audit, or is that just means that they're still processing it? Like, even if I don't get my refund, I'm not going to refund this year, but if you were waiting for a refund and you're just like worried about, you know, if you're just a general worrier like me, if you get that approved, does that mean you're in the clear?
The answer is no. The IRS has 3 years to come after to audit you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so once they're going to process your return, they can get a lot of people, they process the return, they give you the refund, and then you get audited, and then you have to pay it all back.
Okay. We had a great point from the 847 that you can pay all your estimated tax in one lump sum at or mm-hmm. before your first quarter's due date. That way you don't have to mess with three extra checks and stamps. That makes sense. But I'm a big believer of not giving the government the money till they need it, and that I can make some on interest. So.
Well, that's always the case, right? I could pay my taxes for 2 years from now in front. They'll just hold on to it.
Right.
You know, but I don't want to give the money to the IRS either.
630 ask, but hey, 847, that's not me disputing what you want to do. Do it if that makes life easier for you. A lot of people just want to sleep at night, and that's worth it the interest you're going to get. So you do your thing. 630 wants to know, do you need to pay estimated taxes on a 1099-R income, like income over $600 on sales on eBay or other style platforms, or can you just wait till the end of the year for that?
Well, that would be the 1099-K.
Okay.
And the answer is that's going to be your income for next year. Right, so that's going to add if it's income, and then you add. So it's not based on the 1099-K. It's really based on how much you owe the IRS at the end of the year. And the 1099-K is used to track the money that you made to make sure that you put it on as income.
Okay. So I guess what you're saying is, let's say it's just one individual thing you sell on eBay or a couple things you make over $600. That may not be trouble just to sort out at the end of the year. But if that's like your primary, you're making a lot of income from that, you should estimate that early on.
Well, again, that's going to be the same thing as you were just saying.
Okay, right.
If this is your first year doing that, and then at the end of the year you're going to owe money, then the next year you're going to have to pay the estimated tax.
Okay, sounds good.
And Steven, I want to point one thing out.
Yeah.
March 15th is for small. If you have a subchapter S company or a corporation, it is they're due March 15th. So you have to file your taxes. You only have 10 days left.
Oh, your first quarter or no? Your taxes from last year?
No, your tax return. Yeah, for 2021. For businesses, they're due March 15th.
Why do they do that?
Well, because if you're a small business person and they have these flow through companies, which is a subchapter S, I don't want to get too technical, but right, you have to get that done first before you can file your personal tax.
That makes sense. There's always a reason, Stephen. I just need to that's why I have you here, to think through that part of my brain that I can't figure out.
Well, I'm the one that has to read all this stuff, John.
Right.
Oh, by the way, don't you bother reading it. That's what my job is.
Before I put you on hold and take the break, I want to know, even though you're calling me instead of sitting in the studio, are you still wearing a fedora right now, Stephen? Yes or no?
The answer is yes. I want you to think that.
All right, Stephen, I'm putting you on hold. We're taking a break here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Your questions to 312-981-7200. More after this. 6:51 here on WGN. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, till 7 o'clock. Stephen Leahy, WGNTaxman.com. Stephen told me during the break, he said, enough of your problems, John. Let's answer some listener questions. And I agree with you wholeheartedly, Stephen. Let's go to Danny. Danny, you're on WGN. Hey, Danny.
Yes, hi. How are you?
I'm doing good. What's your question?
My question is, I received this letter from PayPal for a form called 1099-K, and it's under my sister's name, but she passed away.
I'm sorry about that.
And I was wondering, what Mr. Leahy, does he have any recommendations what I should do? Because this was in July of last year, and it's a 2021 tax form.
Okay. Stephen, any thoughts?
I'm trying to understand that this was for your sister who's gone now?
Yeah, she's been gone for 4 years, and it's under her name. It says Leahy's name. And then they have her last four SSI number on here.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so they're sending her a 1099. Someone sounds like someone's still using that account.
I don't know who, because I hope they don't think I'm doing it, because it's not me.
They don't have your Social Security number, so they'd have no way of knowing it.
No, they don't have that, and they don't. I didn't sign anything.
Yeah,
this is from an IRO tax operation. The address is 12-12312 Port Grace Boulevard, La Vista. I guess it's Nebraska.
Okay, Stephen, does that sound like fraud?
It may be that's the company that was sending her the 1099 that had signed. So that might be what that is. It's not from the IRS. It's an IRS form, but it's from the company who paid her, it sounds like.
Danny, that's... go ahead.
Can they track this?
The answer is yes, but not to you, because they, you know, that you're not on that account.
Yeah. I talked to...
Here's what I would suggest.
Yes.
Call me on Monday, and I'll take a look at the form, because I can't. I without looking at it, I don't know exactly. So I'd be happy to look at it for you, and give you some advice about it.
You got a pen and paper, Danny, ready for the phone number?
Just one second, please.
All right, we can also.
Yes. Okay.
What do you got?
I'm not linked onto the. I never learned how to use the iPhone and iPad.
Okay,
that's fine. It's a regular telephone, so here's the number. It's 312.
Yes.
664.
664, yes.
6649.
6649.
Mm-hmm. All right, Danny.
Make sure you tell the person who answers that you're from the radio show and I asked you to call.
Okay.
Thanks, Danny.
Thank you very much.
Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Steven doesn't know how to work an iPad either, so Steven, you can relate, right?
That's exactly true.
Really quickly, let's get Rick on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up, man?
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call. Hey, Steve, I just wanted to ask, I have an accountant I filed. He filed for me electronically. I'm still waiting for March of last year for my federal.
Ugh.
Every time I file up, they just keep saying it's being processed, but it's going on a year now.
There's a lot of them still being processed from last year. And so there might be some, I don't know why that if you filed electronically, it wasn't processed correctly, because generally electronic filings are processed right away. And so unless there's some mistake or error calculation, then it would be have to look by a person, and that's what's really behind everywhere. And there's they still have millions of returns from last year.
But I want to just make sure I got this right, Rick. You said it all went through right, like the approved. You're just waiting for the money,
yeah,
literally.
Yeah, John. It all went through. My accountant's been doing mine for
a long
years
time.
And years.
Yeah.
And
I'll tell you, it took me 7 months, Rick, and I mm-hmm. did it electronically too, and everything was fine. And then just one day, mm-hmm. magically, it showed up. So
mm-hmm. here's one thing: if it takes too long, they have to pay you interest on the money that they give you back.
Actually, that's what my account. That's actually my wife had talked to him yesterday. Is exactly what he told her.
So there mm-hmm. you go. You'll get that. Rick, thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, guys. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you again, Steve.
Yeah, you too. Steven,
thank you.
Always good to talk to you, my friend, Steven. WGNTaxman.com, right?
That is correct, John. Thanks so much. And well, I wanted to just mention David Hochberg because he gives me $1 every time I mention his name.
Wait, what about my name? I'll give you $2.
I love you, John Hampton.
Oh, man, $2 right there. Take care, Steven. Have a good one, okay?
Thank you.
All righty. It looks like we're not going to have time for the question of the day already, and I think we're out. Oh, actually, really quickly, let's get Michelle on the line. Michelle, you got a guess to the answer to the question of the day?
I do, yeah. Is it pension? Pension funds, municipal, teachers?
Cops? No, that's a great, I think that's way more than $2 million. I don't know the exact amount.
Oh, I think so, too. Okay.
But thanks for calling, Michelle.
Thanks, John.
We'll roll that over to next Saturday. All right, news next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. What will Illinoisans pay $2.8 million on over the next 15 years? We'll find out next Saturday on Let's Get Legal, perhaps. And can the Russians steal money from your bank account?